you are with the tears on your cheeks, in mufti, in mourning, in some low bar between performances, the jolly barmaid says,
I say, old fellow, what a long face. I know what you need. Go along to the Tivoli and take a look at Buffo the Great. He'll soon bring your smiles back.
The clown may be the source of mirth, but who shall make the clown laugh?
Who shall make the clown laugh? They whispered together, rustling like hollow men.
Little Ivan, oblivious to the meaning of the foreign babbling issuing from the blanched jack-o'-lantern faces that hung over the table, ran round, collecting the clinking soup bowls, unnerved, yet more and more fascinated by this invasion of glum-painted comedians. The meal, such as it was over. All produced pipes, baccy, and fresh vodka, while the babushka, kneeling before the samovar, performed the endless, contentless, semi-prayerful gestures of those hands deformed by decades of common toil. Her daughter, the axe-murderess, was far away in Siberia, but although the babushka's life was composed of these gestures simulating praying, she no longer possessed sufficient energy to pray for her daughter's soul. The charcoal reddened, blackened, reddened.
"And yet," resumed Buffo, after a pull at a bottle, "we possess one privilege, one rare privilege that makes of our outcast and disregarded state something wonderful, something precious. We can invent our own faces. We make ourselves."
He pointed at the white and red superimposed upon his own never-visible features.
"The code of the circus permits of no copying, no change. However much the face of Buffo may appear identical to Grick's face, or to Grock's face, or to Coco's face, or Pozzo Pizzo's Bimbo's faces, or to the face of any other Joey Carpet Clown or August, it is, all the same, a fingerprint of authentic dissimilarity, a genuine expression of my own autonomy. And so my face eclipses me. I have become this face which is not mine, and yet I chose it freely. It is given to few to shape themselves as I have done, as we have done, as you have done, young man. And in that moment of choice, lingering deliriously among the crayons, what eye shall I have, what mouth, exists the perfect freedom. But once the choice is made, I am condemned, therefore, to be Buffo in perpetuity, Buffo forever. Long live Buffo the Great! Who will live on as long as some child somewhere remembers him as a wonder, a marvel, a monster, a thing that, had he not been invented, should have been to teach little children the truth about the filthy ways of the filthy world, as long as a child remembers.
Buffo reached out a long arm and purposefully goosed little Ivan as he passed by with glasses of tea.
"Some child like little Ivan," said Buffo,
who did not know little Ivan had watched from the top of the stove as his mother chopped up his father, and assumed the child was both innocent and naive.
"Yet," he went on, "am I this Buffo whom I have created? Or did I, when I made up my face to look like Buffo's, create ex nihilo another self who is not me? And what am I without my Buffo's face? Why, nobody at all. Take away my makeup and underneath is merely not Buffo. An absence. A vacancy."
Grick and Grock, the pair of musical clowns, old troopers, always together, the Darby and Joan of the clowns, turned their faces towards Walser, bending to catch the feeble lamplight, and he saw those faces were mirror images of one another, alike in every detail, save that Grick's face was left-handed and Grock's face was right-handed.
"Sometimes it seems," said Grock,
that the faces exist of themselves in a disembodied somewhere, waiting for the clown who will wear them, who will bring them to life, faces that wait in the mirrors of unknown dressing rooms, unseen in the depths of the glass, like fish in dusty pools, fish that will rise up out of the obscure profundity when they spot the one who anxiously scrutinises his own reflection for the face it lacks. Man-eating fish, waiting to gobble up your being and give you another instead. But as for us old comrades that we are, old stagers that we are, said Grick, why, do I need a mirror when I put my makeup on? No, sir. All I need to do is look in me old pal's face, for when we made our face together, we created of nothing each other's Siamese twin, our nearest and dearest, bound by a tie as strong as shared liver and lights. Without Grick, Grock is a lost syllable, a typo on a programme, a sign painter's hiccup on a billboard. And so is he, sans me. Oh, young man, you 1st of May, we cannot tell you. How would we have sufficient words to tell you just how useless we used to be before Grick and Grock came together and pooled our two uselessnesses, abandoned our separate empty faces for the one face, our face, brought to bed the joint child of our impotences, turned into more than the sum of our parts according to the dialectics of uselessness, which is nothing plus nothing equals something. Once, you know the nature of plus. Having delivered themselves of the equation of the dialectic, they beamed with gratification beneath their impenetrable makeup. But Buffo wasn't having any. "Bollocks," he said, heavily, belching. "Beg pardon, but balls, me old fruit. Nothing will come of nothing. That's the glory of it." And the entire company repeated after him, soft as dead leaves rustling. "That's the glory of it. Nothing will come of nothing." Yet the musical clowns, such was their ancient authority within the tribe, stubbornly at once set out to prove they could at least make a little something out of it. For Grick began to hum the softest, tiniest kind of melody, while Grock, his old lover, started to drum softly, his gloved fingertips against the tabletop, hum of a drowsy bee, and rhythm faint as a pulse, but sufficient for the clowns. For the others now rose up from their benches, and in the dim gloom of the Petersburg kitchen, they began to dance. It was the Bergamask, or Dance of the Buffoons. And if it began with the same mockery of gracefulness as the dance of the rude mechanicals in A Midsummer Night's Dream, then soon their measures went sour, turned cruel, turned into a dreadful libel upon the whole notion of dancing. As they danced, they began rhythmically to pelt one another with leftover crusts of black bread, and emptied their vodka bottles over one another's heads. Mugged pain, resentment, despair, agony, death, rose up and pelted, emptied, turn and turn about. The babushka lay drowsing on the stove by now, her ample sorrows forgotten. But little Ivan, entranced, hid in the shadows, and fearfully could not forbear to watch, his thumb stuck firmly in his mouth to give him comfort. The guttering paraffin lamp cast awry shadows on the blackened walls, shadows that did not fall where the laws of light dictated they should. One by one, each accompanied by his twisted shadow, the clowns climbed upon the table, where Grick and Grock remained seated one at each end, like gravestones humming and drumming. One lanky carrot-haired fellow, whose suit was latticed in prismatic colours like a matador's suit of lights, took firm hold of the window-pane check baggy pants of a tiny creature in a red velvet waistcoat, and poured the contents of an entire pint of vodka into the resultant aperture. The dwarf broke out in a storm of silent weeping, and with a backward somersault attached himself to his aggressor's neck, to ride there like the old man of the sea, although the harlequin now began to spin round in such a succession of cartwheels, he soon disappeared in a radiant blur, to reappear in his turn on the back of the dwarf. At which point Walser lost sight of this couple in the melee of the savage jig. What beastly obscene violence, they mimed. A Joey thrust the vodka bottle up the arsehole of an August. The August, in response, promptly dropped his tramp's trousers to reveal a virile member of priapic size, bright purple in colour and spotted with yellow stars, dangling two cerise balloons from the fly. At that, a second August, with an evil leer, took a great pair of shears out of his back pocket and sliced the horrid thing off. But as soon as he was brandishing it in triumph above his head, another lurid phallus appeared in the place of the first. This one bright blue with scarlet polka dots and cerise testicles, and so on, until the clown with the shears was juggling with a dozen of the things. It seemed that they were dancing the room apart. As the babushka slept, her too solid kitchen fell into pieces under the blows of their disorder, as if it had been all the time an ingenious prop, and the purple Petersburg knight inserted jagged wedges into the walls around the table, on which these comedians cavorted with such little pleasure, in a dance which could have invoked the end of the world. Then Buffo, who had been sitting in his Christ's place all this while, with the impassivity of the masked, gestured to little Ivan, to innocent little Ivan, to bring to the table that black iron cauldron from which the fish soup had been served, and place it before him. And so the tranced child stepped into the act. Rising ceremoniously to his feet, the master clown fished within the cauldron and found there all manner of rude things, knickers, lavatory brushes, and yard upon yard of lavatory paper. Anality, the one quality that indeed they shared with children. Chamber pots appeared from nowhere, and soon several wore them on their heads, while Buffo served up more and yet more disgusting tidbits from the magic depths of his pot, and dealt them with imperial prodigality about his retinue. Dance of disintegration and of regression, celebration of the primal slime. Little Ivan gaped, near panic, near hysteria, yet all was silent as a summer day. Only the drone and pulse of Grick and Grock, and, like a sound from another world, the occasional snore and groan of the babushka on the stove. In spite of Feather's ministrations and the attentions of the doctor, Walser was still stiff and sore from the embrace of the tiger, and although he knew this display was in some sense put on for his benefit, was even a kind of initiation, he had no great taste for it, and slipped through one of the fissures of the revelry into the freezing alley outside. At the touch of cold, his wound buzzed like a sore. On a crumbling wall, reluctantly lit by a meagre street lamp, was a freshly pasted poster. He could not read the legend, in Cyrillic, but he could see her. Feathers, in all her opulence, in mid-air, in her new incarnation as Circus Star. The Colonel had taken the French dwarf's design, but added to it, by some less skilful hand, representations of the Princess of Abyssinia, the cats, the apes, the clowns themselves, so that they all seemed sheltered by Feather's outspread wings, in the same way that the poor people of the world are protected under the cloak of the Madonna of Misericordia. As Walser eyed this poster sardonically, a shadow detached itself from beneath the street lamp, crossed the street like a gust of wind, and threw itself, weeping at Walser's feet, covering his hands with kisses. Chapter 5. And that was how Walser came to inherit the ape-man's woman, although he did not understand one word she said, except her name, Mignon. And she continued to grovel in the street, clinging to his short pants with her poor, bony hands. She was still dressed as she had been that morning, in the thin, faded cotton wrapper, no coat or shawl, so her bare arms were dappled mauve with cold. The little white rabbit bones of her ankles stuck out above the torn felt carpet slippers on her bare feet. Her limp, light hair dangled from her small head in draggled rat's tails. With his left hand, his good hand, he pulled her upright, and she came easily. She was light as an empty basket. She leant against him, whilst she finished off crying, knuckling her eye sockets like a child. The dark marks on her face could have been either tear stains or bruises. Nothing else moved on the street of warped, shuttered houses. The fog closed down like the lid of a pot. A melancholy dog barked in the distance. In the lodging house behind him, the clown's maligned fiesta. Nowhere to take this waif delivered to him by chance, except... The Madonna of the Arena waggled her bum from the poster. His decision was made. He lyrupped and chirruped to the girl in the way the equestrienne invokes docility in a shy horse, and led her through the maze of hovels until they debouched abruptly upon a glittering street. What thundering noise! What brilliant lights! Crowds of people, of horses, of carriages! Walser was touched to see how little Mignon, accustomed only to poor lodgings and caravans and the underside of spectacle, soon left off sobbing and gazed about her with wonder and excitement. She was adenoidal and breathed through her mouth, but she had a pale, undernourished, unhealthy prettiness. When she stopped crying, she had breath enough to cough. They made a strange pair, a painted streetwalker with a veil over her eyes and a good fur-collared coat, turned to watch them pass. She crossed herself. She thought she saw a pair of holy fools. But the doorman at the Hôtel de l'Europe, in his maroon dress uniform, less superstitious, advanced upon them with his hand outstretched, barring entry through the glass door with a gesture of the guardian of paradise. Walser tried out his few words of Russian, repeated please several times, but the doorman laughed and shook his head. He wore the epaulettes and braided cap of at least a general. Mignon, hanging on Walser's arm, gazed and gazed through the glass door at the fairyland inside, the dazzle of electricity, the furry carpets, the fine ladies, no prettier than herself, who showed their bosoms to bowing gentlemen in evening dress. She gazed with a joyous awe, almost a gratitude, that luxury should exist. She never expected the doorkeeper might relent and let them in. Why should he? She knew better than the foolish clown, such treats were not for the likes of them. But all the same, just the sight of that forbidden sweetie shop, of a hotel foyer, was sufficient in itself to compensate her for a day in which she had been abandoned to the mercies of a hungry tiger by her lover, then beaten to tatters and thrown half-naked onto the Russian winter streets by her husband. She made small guttural sounds of wistful admiration at the back of her throat. Her eyes were big and round as millstones. Then Walser thought he might bribe the doorman, but just as he fumbled under his shirt for the grouch bag, as Grit called it, in which he'd been taught to hide his rubles, a firm hand in a bronze kid glove descended on his good shoulder, whilst another, similarly clad, flourished before the doorman's eyes two pink slips of paper, which he recognised as complimentaries for the opening night of the greatest show on earth. He and Mignon were swept at once into the warm, perfumed air inside in Feather's wake, as the doorman bowed almost to the ground with civility and gratitude. Her suite appeared to be furnished exclusively in flowers, but peering beneath a couple of bushels of white lilac, Feathers located a red velvet armchair the size of a sitz-bath and plumped down in it, kicking away her high-heeled shoes and shrugging off a flowery Spanish shawl with gestures of furious exhaustion. Under her shawl, she wore an extravagant satin dress in that shade of red blondes are told to avoid because it drains them. But it did not drain Feathers, whose rouge was even brighter. Her dress was decorated with flounces of black lace and cut down at the front almost to her nipples, probably in an attempt to distract attention from her hump. All the same, tomorrow, she growled morosely, all the fine ladies in Petersburg will go hunchbacked. Another social triumph, Mr. Walser. Misericordia was in a vile temper. What's this the cat's brought in? She inquired, eyeing Mignon coldly. Quick, old Liz, run her a bath before we catch something off her. Lizzie, throwing Walser an old-fashioned look, stumped off into the bathroom to do as she was bid. Blissfully unaware of their cool welcome, the girl, looking no older than 13 in the remorseless light of the electric chandeliers, was quite overcome by the drawing-room, and turned round and round in one spot on the carpet, drinking everything in. The beautiful pictures on the walls, spindly-legged tables holding onyx ashtrays and chalcedony cigarette boxes. The merry log fire, plush, glitter, and high-piled rugs. Oh! As she watched the starveling girl's delight, Feather's good nature fought with her resentment. She sighed, softened, and addressed Mignon in a clatter of languages, Italian, French, German, all barbarously pronounced and grammatically askew, but rapid as machine-gun fire. When she struck German, the girl smiled. Feathers poked about beneath a festering collation of orchids, retrieved a beribboned box the size of a kettle drum, cast aside the lid, and revealed layer upon layer of chocolates, packed in frilly tutus of white paper. She thrust the box at Mignon. "Go on, stuff yourself. Essen, goot." Mignon, gawky as a boy, clasped the box to her bosom, sniffing with half-closed eyes, almost swooning at the mingled odours of infantine voluptuousness, cocoa, vanilla, praline, violet, caramel, that rose up from the ruffled depths. She seemed hardly able to dare to touch them. Feathers brusquely chose a fat choc with a lump of crystallized ginger pressed on top of it, and popped it into the pale pink mouth that opened like a sea anemone to engulf it. A glittering snail trail of the strong man's dried semen ran down Mignon's leg. She stank. Until she married the ape man, she followed a strange profession. She used to pose for the dead. She was the child of a young man who killed his wife, the mother of his children, for lying down with soldiers from a nearby barracks. This young man took the woman out to a pond on the edge of town, cut her throat, threw the knife into the pond, and came back to their lodgings in good time to prepare supper for their children. Mignon and her little sister were playing in the square outside. Mignon skipped, and her sister turned the rope. She was 6, her sister 5. They saw their father come back. "Supper will be ready soon," he said. He went into the house. There was blood on his shirt, but didn't he work in the slaughterhouse? Wasn't his job that of washing down the slaughterhouse floor? So they took no notice of the blood on his shirt, or of his wet trousers. But he came out of the house in a minute. "The bread knife is lost," he said. "I must go and find the bread knife." Later, people asked the children if he were acting strangely. But how can a 6-year-old, a 5-year-old, tell what is strange behaviour and what is not? The bread knife had never been lost before. That was strange. But father often got the supper because mother took in washing for the soldiers at the barracks and went out in the evenings to deliver the starched shirts so the officers could have them fresh in time for dinner. "Bath's ready," said Lizzie from an open door in a billow of flower-scented steam. Mignon tussled with her wrapper, but since she could not let go of the box of chocolates, shifting it from beneath one arm to beneath the other as she struggled with her sleeves, it took her some time to emerge. She hugged the ribboned box so close you would have thought she had fallen in love with the chocolates. Since he could not make their supper without cutting bread, her father went off to look for the bread knife in the pond, and searched for it so industriously that he drowned himself in 5 feet of water. They found the bread knife when they dragged the pond.
"Is this your bread knife?"
asked the judge, quite kindly. "Yes," said Mignon, and stretched out her hand for it, but they would not let her take it back. That was later. The little girls went on skipping in the square until it got dark. Mignon took her turn at turning the rope. The other end of the rope was tied to the door handle. Now, all the windows in the house had lights in them, but not their window. Then her sister was hungry, so they untied the rope and went upstairs. Mignon did not know how to make a light, but she found the loaf by touch on the table in the dark and broke pieces off it, for her sister and herself. So they ate that.
"God!"
exclaimed Feathers when she saw Mignon's nakedness. Mignon's skin was mauvish, greenish, yellowish, from beatings. And More than the marks of fresh bruises on fading bruises on faded bruises, it was as if she had been beaten flat, and all the pile, the shine banged off her adolescent skin, had been beaten threadbare, or as if she had been threshed or beaten to the thinness of beaten metal, and the beatings had beaten her back almost into the appearance of childhood. For her little shoulder blades stuck up at acute angles. She had no breasts, and was almost hairless, but for a little flaxen tuft on her mound. Unconscious of their startled looks, she dropped her wrapper on the floor and scampered to the bathroom, all legs and elbows. She did not forget to take her chocolates with her. Lizzie picked up the discarded garment with the fire tongs and dropped it on the blaze, where it flared, crackled, turned into a black ghost of itself, and disappeared up the chimney. Feathers put a summoning finger on the room service bell. The small girls cried and slept. In the morning, Father did not come. Only the neighbours came. Of the inquest, Mignon retained only the vaguest memory, vaguer than that of the banks of offal in the frying pan when her father stole a handful of guts from the slaughterhouse, or of the pretty ribbon a soldier gave her that her mother took away again. Why had she done that? And now she was a grown girl. She could have recalled, of her father, only a smell of stale meat and a pair of blonde moustaches that always dropped down at the tips. His moustaches, which had entirely submitted to despair long before he seized the bread knife, concealed it in his shirt, took his wife by the hand and led her out to look at sunset, reflected in the water. Of her mother, hands moist with soap suds, hands that took things away from her, and tears, inscrutable in memory as they had been in life. Those tears that came when the faithless woman clasped her daughters to her bosom as she sometimes, although infrequently, would do. In the short space of time Feathers had been in Petersburg, it seemed she had mastered sufficient bad Russian to order meals, and she added, as an afterthought, a bottle of that international beverage, champagne. Clearly Mignon's condition had melted her heart, although, by the rasp of her blue eyes when she cast them at Walser, one would never have thought so. Housed in the city orphanage, the children prayed, and the rest of the time busied themselves with household tasks. Then it was as if her sister went one way and Mignon the other. One morning, they woke in one another's arms in the same bed, and that night Mignon went to sleep on a heap of rags in the corner of a kitchen full of dark shapes of spits and pots and jars and presses to flatten ducks. She bore it for 6 months, because it was winter, and the house in which she skivvied was stuck in the middle of the country in the middle of the snow. But when it was spring, she ran away, and a peasant taking a load of cabbages to the city gave her a lift in exchange for sucking his prick. She did not dare go back to the orphanage, although for a long time she used to hang around the outside, on the off chance her sister might still be there. But she never saw her sister again, so she supposed she got a good place somewhere too. Throughout the summer, Mignon made a living picking up discarded flowers in the market and putting them together in crippled bunches. She learned to exercise some ingenuity in arranging these little nosegays, and also soon learned to augment her trouvaille with blooms picked from public gardens. But it wasn't a good living. It was begging with paint on its face, and she stole other things, food, odd items of clothing, in order to get by. She slept where she could, in passages, under bridges, in shop doorways, and it was all right, as long as it was warm. She soon made a large acquaintance among the other street Arabs, the accidental children of the city, and when the cold weather came, she pooled resources with an entire gang of young creatures who made their headquarters in a disused warehouse. From beggar to thief is one step, but a step in two directions at the same time, for what a beggar loses in morality when he becomes a thief, he regains in self-respect. Yet however accomplished in pickpocketing, these children of the lower depths remained children.
They made themselves big bonfires at nights, partly to warm themselves, partly for the fun of the flames crackling. They would play games of tag and hide-and-seek and jump across the embers and fall to childish quarrelling and squabbling among themselves. And then the fire got too big for its boots, consumed their headquarters, ate up some of them, too. The home and the family Mignon had invented for herself went up in smoke, and she was on her own again. So she thieved a bit, and tossed off nervous boys in back alleys for a few coppers, and let them put it into her against dreary walls for a few coppers more. She would have been about 14 then. The waiter knocked and rolled in a clinking trolley, a tureen and champagne in a silver ice bucket, deliriously misted with chill. The waiter spread a place on one of the gay little tables with a shining white cloth, all the while furtively peering at Fever's noble cleavage, until Walter felt a strange desire rise within him to punch the young man's nose. If Fever's had ordered food for only Mignon, there were four glasses, like saucers on stems. These she peremptorily signed to be changed for flutes, a scrupulosity of refinement that charmed Walter. Fever's raised the lid of the tureen, bread and milk for the abused child, a maternal touch. She scooped some up on her finger, tasted it, made a wry face, sprinkled sugar lavishly from the silver caster. She replaced the lid and tucked a napkin round the tureen to keep its contents warm. In spite of these hospitable preparations, the Cockney Venus remained in a foul mood, darting Walser speaking glances of contempt and irritation from eyes that tonight were as dark a blue as sailors' trousers. Ecstatic splashing and coos of delight came through the edges of the bathroom door, together with little puffs of steam. Then Mignon began to sing. She possessed a sweet, artless soprano. So far, so good. To that extent, her voice matched her immature body. But it was as though the scarcely-to-be-imagined tragedy of her life, the sea of misery and disaster in which she swam in her precarious state of innocent defilement, all found expression, beyond her consciousness of her intention, in her voice. She sang, "So we'll go no more a-roving, so late into the night, though the heart be still as loving, and the moon shines still as bright." All three who listened felt the hairs rise on the napes of their necks, as if that lovely voice was something uncanny, its possessor either herself a sorceress or under some spell. "I thought she didn't speak English," muttered Fevers, ruffled, as if the child had been deceiving them.
"Don't you see?" whispered Lizzie. "She knows the words, but she doesn't understand them."
One winter's night, as the snowflakes whirled around the chimney pots, Mignon, bold with hunger, strayed into the arcades of the commercial part of the city, where she rarely ventured. A gentleman, in a snug greatcoat and a top hat rendered melancholy by the weight of snow upon its brim, came hurrying down the pavement towards her, absorbed in his own affairs. She put herself in his path. She had not eaten for 2 days. She was so thin she did not cast a shadow. He made as if to brush her off, as though she were a fly who settled on his arm, but then, glancing abstractedly at her face, an expression of low cunning and mean surmise crossed his own. He was a medium, and held office hours in his comfortable apartment above a grocer's shop on the next block. Delicious odours of cloves, dried apricots and ham sausage seeped up through the cracks in the floorboards, and for the first time in her life, Mignon got enough to eat. But she did not put on any weight. It was as though something inside her ate it all up before she could get to it. But she didn't have worms. This man, Herr M., had been returning home from a service at the spiritualist church where he occasionally officiated when he encountered the little streetwalker with a shawl over her head. He had indeed been preoccupied with a serious problem, to which her appearance provided the solution. For only the previous week, his assistant, A buxom lass from Schleswig-Holstein, whom he trusted absolutely, ran off with a Brazilian gentleman, a travelling salesman, who visited the grocer downstairs with samples of coffee. She, having slipped downstairs one day to buy a snack of cheese and cookies, the pomaded and expansive Latin took time off from his little bags of green beans to bandy words with her in an irresistibly syncopated accent. She accepted his invitation to lunch in a fashionable restaurant one Sunday when Herr M., the medium, was visiting his aged aunt in a tree-shaded suburb. One thing led to another, and if the medium had keen eyes for the world beyond, he was blind as a bat to the developments taking place under his nose, until, under that nose, pinned in fact to the very pillow on which he was accustomed to wake to find her pigtailed head, he discovered instead the note, advising him she was already on the train that would take her to the port from whence she and her beau would embark for Rio. The absconding assistant took a few bits and pieces of portable property, such as Herr M.'s gold watch and a roll of banknotes he had deposited inside the grandfather clock for safe keeping. But he was a magnanimous man, and felt he owed her that much. He also felt some relief that far away in sunny Brazil, she would be in no position to spill another kind of beans than those in which her senor dealt, but he was gravely inconvenienced to be without an assistant, and regarded his meeting with Mignon as truly ordained by the spirits. It was her great resemblance to a spectre that struck him most. "For the sword outwears the sheath, and the heart outwears the breast, and love itself must cease, and the heart itself take rest." Mignon sang her foreign song, without meaning, without feeling, as if the song shone through her, as though she were glass, without the knowledge she was heard. She sang her song, which contained the anguish of a continent. Herr M., a once-a-night on-and-off man, screwed Mignon with the absent-minded regularity with which he wound the grandfather clock, although never for quite so long. As for Mignon, she could hardly believe her luck. A bed with sheets, an armchair, a warm stove, a table with a cloth, mealtimes. He had her deloused, paid a doctor to ensure a clean bill of health. Miraculously, she had escaped infection, and sent her to the dentist, who pulled her rotten molars, greatly increasing the resemblance of her face to a skull thereby. Because she possessed only the rag she stood up in, he bought her several sets of underwear, some dresses of thrifty wool and cotton mix for every day, and for working hours, some pretty white nighties trimmed with broderie anglaise. She did not need a coat, because he never let her out of the apartment. Mignon thought she was in heaven, but it was a fool's paradise, and in literal terms, that is an exact description of Herr M.'s establishment. Herr M. had early formulated the following maxim. "Why steal, when there is more intellectual satisfaction to be obtained from cheating?" Mignon's daily work henceforward consisted of personating the dead and posing for their photographs. Every morning over breakfast, Herr M. studied the obituary columns in the newspaper, marking the deaths of young women with a mourning stripe of thick black pencil. Although young wives, preferably those who died in childbed, sometimes proved eminently satisfactory, marital relations could turn sticky on occasions, and best of all, he preferred the demises of only daughters, of elderly parents. Epidemics of diphtheria and scarlet fever always put a smile on his lips, and set him a-tapping at the top of his egg with an especially jaunty air. After he consumed his egg, his cheese, his salami, his toast, and a couple of spoonfuls of preserves, he enjoyed a hearty breakfast. He settled down with a second cup of coffee and entered the satisfactory results of his researches in his filing system. Sometimes solemn as an undertaker and garbed in similar fashion, he attended those funerals where he judged there would be so few mourners that his presence would be remembered, and sent to others exquisitely chosen flowers, such as a bunch of white violets or a garland of scarcely opened rosebuds, accompanied by his black-edged card. But on the whole,
He did not believe in striking while the iron was hot. No, he let the first fierce grief pass before he closed in. He preferred to work on subjects who knew from experience they were inconsolable. He prided himself on his knowledge of the human heart. So, for the main part, he relied on word-of-mouth advertising and kept up excellent relations with wreath-makers, embalming parlours, and monumental masons. Of all his clients, he liked best those who sought him out independently. Cheeks creased with a trace of tears, they would come to inquire tentatively, often in almost an embarrassed way, at the Spirit Church, where the verger, an aged Swedenborgian of impeccably lunatic integrity, would take the names and addresses, and allow Herr M. to approach them at his leisure. He liked to make them wait a little, not too much, only enough to let them understand how difficult were the negotiations he must make.
"And shall we see her? Shall we truly see her?"
"Oh, yes. She will cross from the abyss from beyond. She will leave her couch in beds of asphodel and materialize in this very apartment. When the curtains are drawn in the dim light, she cannot stand the sunshine now, you see, nor the artificial glare of the gas mantle, but she will bring with her her own radiant mist." All young girls look the same after a long illness. Mignon wore a white nightgown buttoned to the neck, and her hair loose. The bereaved sat around the mahogany table with a red plush cover, edged with a fringe of balls. They clasped hands. Herr M. was solid and reliable as a bank manager in his expansive waistcoat and his dark green velvet jacket and his oleaginous sentimentality. There was a little skullcap embroidered with arcane signs that he put on for his seances. His aunt sewed it for him. He believed the best illusions were the simplest. However, as a hobby, he experimented with various optical toys and magic lanterns of the most sophisticated kind. Herr M. spent considerable sums on such devices, engaged in perfectly respectable research on systems of mechanical reproduction, and indeed possessed many of the characteristics of a scientist manqué. He was sincerely fascinated by the art and craft of illusion, and during the entire time that Mignon worked for him, he was conducting a learned correspondence with a certain Mr. Robert Paul in London about an invention which Mr. Paul had patented. Mr. Paul claimed his invention would materialize the human desire to live in the past, the present, and the future all at once. It consisted of a screen on which was projected at random a number of sequences of pictures showing simulated scenes from time past, time present, and time to come, whilst the audience, seated in comfortable fauteuil, were subjected to a soft breeze directed at them from a hand-cranked wind machine to simulate the wind of travel. Herr M. even began discussions on behalf of his colleague with a troupe of dancers who worked in a cabaret he knew of, that they would personate historical personages for his own camera. He was, it goes without saying, an excellent photographer, all above board and in perfect taste. But although he was passionately devoted to this hobby and spent most of his spare hours closeted in his study with his praxinoscope, his phasmotrope, and his zoopraxiscope, projecting onto a white screen photographs of plants and animals that often seemed to move, these studies remained no more than peripheral to his business, which consisted of fleecing the living by arranging interviews with their departed. "She will not speak. She will not smile. Ah, how illness has changed her, how it has ravaged her little face, but in the happy land where now she dwells, there is no sickness, no pain. Oh, my darling, hush, don't burden her with your grief, for pity's sake."
So you can see there were still traces of common humanity in Herr M., and these he often applauded in himself. Did he not comfort? Did he not console? Did he not, out of the goodness of his compassionate heart, assuage the suffering souls who brought their pain into his parlour? Had he not hit upon that one compassionate innovation that set him apart from other mediums?
Could he not sell his unhappy clients authentic pictures of the loved and lost ones, that proved in whatever world they now inhabited, they flourished still? He busily interpreted unheard voices, with the best of intentions.
"She begs you, Papa, Mama, don't cry." Or, "She's saying that she cannot rest in peace while you still grieve."
Herr M. tucked the banknotes into his grandfather clock with a satisfaction that was not purely physical, was at least partly that of a justified Samaritan.
"If they didn't pay, they wouldn't believe, and then they'd get no benefit at all. At all."
His L-shaped drawing room had lace curtains looped over the archway to the foot of the L, beside the green glazed jardiniere on which stood a Boston fern. Pointing towards this alcove was Herr M.'s mahogany camera, like a little wooden room itself. Behind the camera stood the round table at which Herr M. joined the hands of the parents as solemnly as if he were marrying them, and begged them, in an urgent whisper, to stay stock still. Although their line of vision was somewhat obscured by the camera, they always did as they were bid, never craned or peered, too much in awe. If the mourner came alone, Herr M. would clamp his or her hands down on the table with the assurance that, if contact with the plush were lost for one single moment, the ghost would vanish. The alcove itself was always in darkness, and purple clouds of incense billowed out from Chinese pots. The bookcase against the further wall swung inwards on well-oiled hinges. Herr M. went round, dimming the rest of the lights.
"It's only Mummy and Daddy, little one, come to visit you."
Or,
"Won't you come to Hubby? Won't you come back to Hubby?"
Whatever suited the client's condition. They sat at the table, held hands, and hoped.
"Come, then I knock on the table, little one."
Mignon, in her nightgown, slipped into the alcove from behind the bookcase. She carried an electric torch under her nightgown so that her outline glowed. It was as simple as that. Lit from beneath, clouded with incense, half hidden by the lace curtains, the reticulated fronds of fern and the bulk of the camera, she could have been any young girl. And when they saw their heart's desire, their eyes were often blind with tears. She smiled. Sometimes she held a lily in her hand and could hide behind it, if Herr M.'s tactful inquiries had discovered any facial peculiarity about the deceased, a squint, a hare lip, something like that. A breeze blew through the room, sweetly rattling the chimes of glass harp behind her. Herr M. ducked his head under the hood of the camera. In the unexpected thunder and lightning of the flash, Mignon's face looked to each one who saw it the perfect image of the lost. When the smoke cleared, she was gone, and Herr M. went about lighting up the gas mantles again. Why was he proficient only at summoning female ghosts? Because, he implied, taking out his tobacco-scented handkerchief and blowing his nose, as if concealing manly emotion in a manly fashion, he himself, once, long ago, in a kingdom by the sea. Her high-born kinsman arrived in due course and took her away, but Herr M. contrived a deal with the high-born kinsman, provided he invoked exclusively spirits in the same category, to wit, young girls. In spite of this specification, Mignon got a nasty fright the very first time he took her photograph. She went into the dark room with him out of curiosity, and excitedly watched the picture crystallize on the paper as if by magic in the trough of acid. But then she tucked her underlip under her rather prominent front teeth. She was troubled. For the face that swam out from the acid emerged to her out of her memory in the same way.
"Mother."
Herr M. hugged her with genuine compassion.
"Accidents can happen," he apologized.
In his undertaker's weeds, he delivered the photographs by hand, each wrapped in a crisp shroud of tissue paper.
"The spirits are shy," he would assure his patrons. "She wishes only those she loves best to see her thus. Show these photographs to nobody, or else her face will disappear."
The indistinct features, melting into darkness surrounding them, were those of whomever longing and imagination made them. He tipped his gloomy topper and accepted gratitude as if it were his due. Mignon impersonated the dead so successfully that her M even briefly contemplated giving her a salary as well as her keep, but decided that if he did so, she might save up and run away. So they lived out an odd kind of illicit, respectable life together. He was pleased to find she could sing a little, and often wondered if there was a way he could incorporate her fresh, untrained voice in the act. Angelic voices, perhaps. But then he thought, it will make things too complicated, and left her alone a good deal, curled up in an overstuffed armchair in the drawing room, lost in incoherent daydreams, whilst in his study he probed the problems of persistence of vision. He lasted so long because he was venal but not greedy, and always behaved with tact, discretion, and even kindness. Finally, a mother could not resist it, showed the photograph of a dead darling to an older sister, whose nose had been put so far out of joint by the late arrival that she could not endure the thought of her sibling's posthumous rivalry, stole the portrait and took it to the police. Posing as a bereaved uncle, a burly detective knocked over the camera just as Herr M. fired off the flash and trapped Mignon by the tail of her nightgown as she made a hasty exit through the swinging bookcase. How she giggled. It had never been anything more than a game to her. The jig was up. Herr M., rational as ever, made a full confession at once and produced Mignon in her nightgown in court as irrefutable proof. The scandal killed his aged aunt, unhappily, but Herr M. served only 2 years out of 6 in prison, maximum remission for good behaviour, making a number of valuable contacts amongst other upstanding embezzlers, frauds and confidence men, whilst inside. On his release, he moved immediately to another city, where after a few difficult months, he set up in business again, although this time he forswore spiritualism and set up a profitable line in exotic snapshots. He reopened his correspondence with Mr. Paul to such effect that, a year or two later, he was able to give up pornography altogether and went into the motion picture business. He prospered, although sometimes in the teeth of his own scepticism, he felt almost tempted, now and then, to try to pierce the veil just once, this time for real, and have a word with Auntie, whom he missed terribly. Yet many of those who had been deceived by Herr M. did not believe in his confession. They took the cherished photographs out of those lavender-scented bureau drawers in which they shared an old glove box with, perhaps a first curl in an envelope, or a rattle of cast milk teeth, and however hard they scrutinized the glossy prints, they never saw Mignon's face, but saw another face, and heard in their mind's ear the soft, familiar voice demanding the impossible, "Mama, Papa, don't cry." So you could say the evidence of Herr M.'s crime remained in itself perfectly innocent. Oh, dear delusion. And still Mama sleeps with the picture under her pillow. Mignon got off scot-free. No charges were so much as pressed against her, secure as she was in the victim's defence of no responsibility. Now she had some nice clothes. She got herself a decent job, serving in quite a good class of bar, and she had a little room of her own, and often thanked her lucky stars. She would sing, too, when the accordion player came round. She loved to sing. Sometimes she went home with the accordion player, sometimes not. She picked and chose. Those were her best days. Although there was always something feckless about her, something slack and almost fearful in her too frequent smile, so that when you saw Mignon being happy, you always thought, it can't last. She had the febrile gaiety of a being without a past, without a present, yet she existed thus, without memory or history, only because her past was too bleak to think of, and her future too terrible to contemplate. She was the broken blossom of the present tense. One Saturday night, a gentleman in evening dress, under an elegant red-lined cape,
came into the bar hand in hand with a miniature edition of himself, all but for the feet, for this little person, squat in stature, somewhat long in the arm, could find no shoes to fit him in any shop in the world. They took a booth in a corner, and Mignon, full of curiosity, trotted over to serve them. The small person's sleek black hair was combed back from a centre parting. With grave ceremony, he took the carnation from his buttonhole and handed it to Mignon. She burst out laughing.
"Don't hurt his feelings," said the ape-man in a charming French accent.
So Mignon took the flower and fixed it in her hair. The ape-man ordered a bottle of wine, and Mignon begged a banana from the kitchen.
"My friend and colleague, the professor. Give the pretty lady a kiss, professor."
The professor was already investigating the banana, but he put it down carefully on his plate, stood up on his chair, leaned across the table, put his arms round Mignon's neck, and gave her a smacking, tickling kiss on the cheek. You could say the professor did the ape-man's courting for him.
Yes, she'd be delighted to share their wine.
She was still only 15, and he took her on solely in order to abuse her. He had such a fine nose for a victim, it was a wonder he'd elected to spend his life among the astute chimps, who whisked out of the way of his boot, and if he got them no supper, would steal his wallet from the pocket of his jacket as he lay on his bunk in a drunken stupor, and go out and buy supper for themselves. He was a dark man out of Lyon, and his eyebrows met. She went back to his van, he was with a travelling circus then, that put up its canvas in parks, and next morning, gawped like a child at the wise monkeys washing their faces in a bucket and queuing up to comb their hair at the cracked square of mirror in their travelling cage. She did not bother to go back to her own room to pick up her clothes. She ran away with the circus, although it turned out he was a drinking man, hard, taciturn, violent. On the third day on the road, he beat her because she burned the cutlets. She was a lousy cook. On the fourth day, he beat her because she forgot to empty the chamber pot, and when he pissed in it, it overflowed. On the fifth day, he beat her because he had formed the habit of beating her. On the sixth day, a roustabout got her down on her back behind the freak show. The beating was now an expectation that was always fulfilled. On the seventh day, three Moroccan acrobats took her back to their van, gave her some raki, which made her cough, some hashish, which made her eyes shine, and then had her, in a variety of ingenious ways, one after the other, among the shining brass and cut-glass ornaments of the teak interior. Word about Mignon passed round quickly. She had an exceedingly short memory, which alone saved her from desolation. There was a stable boy from England, an odd type, who heard her singing as she swept out the chimps' cages, and taught her a lot of new songs, some, though not all, of which had very rude words, not that Mignon understood them. He liked to hear the way-faced orphan singing obscenities that were meaningless to her, but he also liked to hear her sing other kinds of songs, for he was a musical boy, and she learned from him some German songs about the quick trout and the rose in the heather, and more. He spoke good German, but kept himself to himself, for he had a secret. He was running away from a scandal at his public school. He liked boys too much, and left Mignon alone, for which she was grateful. She would go and sit with him in an odorous corner of the horse box, and they would sing in harmony, "Jolly boating weather, the lark now leaves his watery nest." One day, the ape-man knocked him insensible with a broom, and beat her until the broom broke, but the boy never recovered consciousness. They were on the road, camped outside a scrubbed conurbation of cuckoo clocks in Switzerland, and the ape-man dragged the boy into some bushes and left him there. The ape-man's evening suit and cape, the uniform in which he escorted his charges into the ring, swung from a wooden coat-hanger, stolen from a Paris hotel, on a peg in caravans, in lodging houses, in dressing rooms. She bore this dress suit no resentment, although it had deceived her, and if she soon lost interest in the chimps too, she did not treat them badly. She did their laundry and mended their costumes. The professor never gave her another flower, but then she never gave him another banana. What the chimps thought about all this is a problem. One who had made a profound study of those creatures as they went through their routines that mocked us, the cycle race, the tea party, the schoolroom, might have concluded that the apes, in turn, were putting their own studious observations of ourselves to use in routines of parody, of irony, of satire. The more the ape man drank, the more they ignored him.